Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. It's open forum today, and we got 2 hours with Tim Staples. And that means the phone lines are going to light up. So if you would like to get in with a question for Tim, 888-318-7884 is the number. 888-318-7884. Open forum is for anybody with any question at all about the Catholic faith. Whether you're Catholic or not, you are very, very welcome to call. Whether you're short or tall or sleepy or awake. No short people. Why? Because they have no reason.
You knew what I was going to say. And that's a joke, by the way, people.
Yes. It was when Randy Newman did it, and it was a joke now. 888-318-7884 is the number. Tim, as you know, is our director of apologetics and evangelization, and he's the author of Behold Your Mother, a biblical and historical defense of the Marian doctrines. Hello, Tim.
Hello, Cy Kellett.
Are you ready for 2 hours of open forum?
I live for this.
Yeah, I know you do. I know you do. And I know you like it when we do 2 hours.
I do. I feel like I get something done.
We were just reminiscing before the program about, what is it? Jan and Paul Crouch.
Paul and Jan Crouch. And actually, you know, for those of you who don't know, they are the founders of TBN, the Trinity Broadcasting Network.
Oh, they're the founders of that.
They are.
Oh, okay.
They are. They're kind of... Jim and Tammy Baker 2.
Right.
Jim and Tammy were around before them, but they were pretty much, you know, not too long thereafter.
A little mellower, though. A little.
I don't know about that.
Not really?
They're both pretty wild.
When you were,
but I have to say, Paul Crouch Jr., the son of Paul Crouch, helped us do our lighting in here. Do you remember that?
I wasn't here then. I didn't know that.
Yes, he was very,
I would have loved to
helpful.
Have met him because I watched them a lot when I was younger.
Oh, yeah.
A lot.
Good people.
When you were kind of evangelical preacher, is that the right way to say it?
Pentecostal.
Okay, sorry.
I was raised evangelical, but I became a Pentecostal.
Did you meet a lot of TV preachers?
Oh, sure, sure. You did? Well, of course, I met Jim Baker and Tammy. My parents were, and I, although they paid for it, so it was theirs, but I happily went along with them. We were timeshare owners in the famous Heritage USA, Jim and Tammy's big thing that ended up sending Jim to prison.
Yeah, so, I kind of remember all that. I don't remember exactly what happened, but I know that.
Well,
they
scammed. They were big time overselling the condo units.
Oh. Yeah.
And
you're not supposed to do that?
No.
Oh.
they were just selling them away. Even if they didn't exist, they were selling them away.
Oh.
But it was actually a wonderful place. We went there. We used to go there all the time. So I met them. Of course, I went to Jimmy Swaggart Bible College, so I met him.
Yeah.
His wife, Frances, his son, Donnie. And these are good people. I mean, they're good
Christian
people.
I always got that sense about the Crouches. I mean, I only knew them from watching them on TV.
I never met them, but... These are good people that love Jesus. Yeah. You know, in the case of Jimmy Swaggart, you know, theologically, he's just if you read his book, Catholicism versus Christianity, you get a sense, you know, this guy's in way over his head. He's just a good guy that loves Jesus, doesn't know theology, and the book is horrible. But I remember reading it in 1986 because I was, you know, excited about proving the Catholic Church false. That was one of the books that I read along with lots of others. But I was all excited reading that book, and little did I know there are errors on about every page.
Yeah,
you know, and some of them grievous. But you know, again, I love them to death, all of them, and they just need the fullness of the gospel of Jesus Christ that we alone possess as Catholics, as does every person in this world.
Amen. And by the way, that whole conversation came about because Tim was preaching to me before we went on the air, and it was good, too.
I was using my Pentecostal voice. You know when I start talking like that. All right.
Well. lots and lots of calls. Again, the number is 888-318-7884. First up is Christian in Dallas. Listening on the Catholic Answers live app. Christian, do we have you with us?
Yep. How's it going?
Very well. Your question for Tim.
Yes.
All right. Well, I have to preface this first, Tim, by saying you are the bomb.com. You're my favorite person to listen to on Open Forum, and I'm really excited to get to ask you my question. Okay. Cy, you're all right.
Ah, come on. All right. I'm just glad I get to be near the bomb.com.
All right. Thank you, brother. It's great to hear from you.
Oh, I dropped him by accident. Oh, sorry, Christian. I let him go.
Oh, dear.
No, so, go ahead. Your question.
What's on your mind, brother?
Well, Tim, you helped me once before. So some of my best friends are Orthodox. And, in fact, one of them is a former Romanian Pentecostal.
Okay.
And we hang out a lot. And we talk church history, and we've gotten into a couple of debates before. I've really gotten into apologetics because of it, aside from trying to convert my Protestant girlfriend.
Right.
And my main question is really how to make the case for the papacy, particularly to an Orthodox person. I've heard this argument time and time after time again with them that the early church was ruled by ecumenical councils and that the modern day powers of the Pope is sort of a new thing.
Right.
And also another argument I've heard from them is the Catholic Church broke away from the Orthodox Church and not vice versa.
Right.
I even went to a public high school where it was taught that similar argument.
Sure.
So I'd really like to know how to touch on both things the next time we get into a friendly debate.
Great, great question, Christian. And I'm going to recommend you get a hold of a CD set I did here at Catholic Answers called The Shocking Truth About the Pope and the Early Church Fathers. What I do in that CD set, and I recommend it for everybody listening, I put a whole lot into these CDs. It's about 6 hours of teaching. I start with the scriptures and show, you know, biblically speaking, and I have to tell you this, Christian, I, for a time, considered orthodoxy during my odyssey to the Catholic faith, but it was the papacy that just stuck out like a sore thumb in the scriptures as well as in church history, and that's one of the reasons why I did that CD set. But, you know, from the Gospels, where it's quite obvious that Jesus among when he chose the 12, from the 12. It is so obvious in the Gospels, Christian, it's painfully obvious that he chooses one to be the chief apostle. In fact, Matthew calls him the chief apostle in Matthew chapter 10, verse 2. And for your Orthodox friend, especially our Greek Orthodox friends, the Greek word is protos there. That does not mean first in chronology. Of course, Andrew was first in John chapter 1, verse 41. He went back to the house and got his knuckleheaded brother, right? Peter. So when it says the first apostle, this is very significant because, as I think you know, Christian, Matthew's writing to a Jewish Christian audience, and the biggest issue that ultimately that was threatening to tear that fledgling Jewish Christian community apart was ultimately the authority of the church and Peter in particular, because Peter is the one we see in Acts chapter 10 who leads the church in bringing the Gentiles in to the dismay of many of the Jews. No, we can't bring the goyim into the church. Are you kidding me? Right? Peter, in fact, Peter didn't want to either, but Jesus led him in quite stark terms there in Acts 10 to bring them into the church. So you can imagine among the Jewish Christians, and when the issue arose among the Judaizers that, we'll let these Gentiles in, but they're going to have to be circumcised. And they were arguing as well, not just that Gentiles had to be circumcised, but everybody did. And it's great that you believe in Jesus, but you also got to go to the temple, offer sacrifice, and do the whole deal. That's why the letter to the Hebrews was written to, yes, the Hebrew Christians, just as Paul is focusing on writing to the Gentile contingency that was being tempted by the Judaizers. The inspired author of Hebrews writes to the Jews. So this was a huge issue. And so in Matthew's gospel, you see emphasized the papacy more than all the other gospels. By far, because this was the big issue for the community to whom he was writing. Just like John, he's writing against the fathers of Gnosticism. Hence, he emphasizes the divinity of Christ, which they denied, the real presence of the Eucharist, which they denied, and other things. So, really important. Matthew, you have chief apostle there, Matthew 10:2. You've got Jesus performing the miracle of the loaves in Matthew chapter 14. Then he walks out on the water, and then what happens? Right? Peter, says, if it be thou, bid me come to thee on the water. And Peter walks on the water. No other Christian nobody ever in history had ever done that before. He walks on the water, right? And when he starts to fall, Jesus says, no, he picks him back up. Why? Because I'm building my church on you. In fact, just two chapters later, he says, I'll build my church upon you. Peter, you are the rock. I mean, it becomes really obvious here, you know, from chapter 10 to 14. Now, 16, promise of the keys, and then 17, the little miracle of, you know, the IRS comes calling there in Matthew 17, starting right around, what is that, about verse 21. And Peter is told by Jesus, go get your fishing pole, cast it in the sea, catch a fish, and there'll be enough money to pay for me and for you. You know, I mean, what in the world is Jesus doing here? If I was Peter, I'd say, can't you just kind of pull a coin out of your pocket? Why do I have to? Well, Jesus is doing this in order to show, and they would never forget,
right,
to show that Peter is given supernatural power, like walking on the water. Here he is going to provide for Peter and also for Jesus. He's acting as vicar of Christ in the place of Christ. I mean, there's many more things we could look at all through the book of Acts. That's important. But here's the point, Christian, you want to make to the Orthodox. Not only do we, and believe me, we could spend hours just in the Gospels and then the epistles, but you want to show what I like to call Acts chapter 29, because right, the book of Acts has 28 chapters, right? Starting with Acts chapter 29, right? With the close of the apostolic age, you have from day one, in fact, even before the close of the apostolic or the era of revelation, you might say, when the revelation was being given to us, you already have Clement of Rome in his letter to the Corinthians, especially paragraphs 42 through 44. But throughout that epistle, he was called upon by the Corinthians when John the Apostle was still alive, most likely back from exile and living in Ephesus right down the road. Yet they appeal all the way to Rome to Clement to deal with the problems and the schisms that were going on there. That's very significant. And then, you know, St. Clement, our third successor of the Bishop of Rome, our fourth pope, hammers him. And uses the, you know, what, just as popes do today, the royal we, the same way Peter did in Acts chapter 15, beginning, where is that, verse 11, down to, 7, Acts 15, 7 down to 11, you see Peter declaring, we believe, the royal we. He speaks for everyone, as opposed to James, who says, I. Peter says, we. You get that from St. Clement. And that's roughly 95 AD, John the Apostle was still alive. This is very significant. And you have Clement, who's mentioned by St. Paul in Philippians chapter 4, verse 3. I mean, this is amazing, right? So right from the get-go, you have the Pope acting like the Pope. And then you've got just about 15 years later, St. Ignatius of Antioch, who writes in his seven letters as he was on his way to being martyred for the faith, he writes seven letters to seven churches, one of them being the Church of Rome. And it's phenomenal when you read it, especially compared to the other six. Like if you look, for example, at his letter to the Magnesians in paragraph 6, he talks about how the bishop presides over the people there. Among the Magnesians, the bishop presides. Whereas when he gets to the church at Rome, not only does his language change because he uses all sorts of flowery adulation for the church at Rome, but he says of the Church of Rome that it presides in love in the country of the Romans. It presides, the church presides. Whereas the bishop presides over his people among the Magnesians, the church itself presides. Why? The church presides over all the other churches. And he uses the language that comes right from John 21:15. Of course, Clement knew John the Apostle. And so he uses the language, you know, it presides in love, just as Jesus said Peter would preside in love in John 21:15. Do you love me? Do you love me? Do you love me? Feed my lambs, shepherd my sheep, feed my lambs, then shepherd my sheep, feed my sheep, right? So he's giving Peter all of his sheep to preside in love. And so what does St. Ignatius say of the Church of Rome? it presides in love over the other churches. And believe me, Christian, we could go forever here. St. Irenaeus of Lyon, I'm going to have to cut it here because we do have other phone callers here. But Christian, get that CD set, my brother. I go through the first 700 years of the Christian era and show you how it is entirely Catholic. And I'll leave you with this. St. Irenaeus, in his famous Against Heresies, the greatest apologetic work of the second century, he writes in Book 3, Chapter 3, paragraphs 1 through 3, and I quote, "All other churches must agree with this church," that is the Church of Rome, "because of its special place of preeminence." And he lists all the bishops of Rome all the way back to Peter, and he says, "This is the standard whereby the ecclesiastical tradition and the preaching of the truth have come down even unto us." This is, my friend, just the first 100 years of the church I'm talking about here, and it's this obvious. It gets even more so as you move into the 3rd century, the 4th century, and such. The bottom line, the Orthodox split from the Catholic Church in a most unfortunate split. That's a historical fact, and we pray for full reunification.
Thanks, Christian. We'll have to leave it there. I got to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more Catholic Answers Live, open forum with Tim Staples right after this.
Glad you're with us. Join us on air with your questions today on Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers Live is brought to you in part by CatholicSingles.com, the website for Catholics who want to meet others who share their faith and values for faith, fellowship, and love. You can learn more at CatholicSingles.com. Catholic Answers Live thanks CatholicSingles.com for their generous support.
Homeschool Connections, an online provider of courses for your Catholic homeschool, is a sponsor of Catholic Answers Live. Homeschool Connections' website is homeschoolconnections.com.
What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
I don't understand why I have to earn salvation.
How is it possible that God created everything?
Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest?
Why is the Catholic Church so unwilling to
The Catholic Church is too rich.
Catholics worship Mary and are
committed. As far as I'm concerned, all religions are equal.
You are called to communion with Dr. David Anders. Tonight, 11 p.m. Eastern, on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live, open forum. Hey, right now, you get a deal on subscriptions to Catholic Answers Magazine. Catholic Answers Magazine, one of the finest magazines in the world. Are you happy with the magazine, or how do you feel about it?
It's only the best apologetics magazine in the world.
Oh, okay.
Other than that, I don't really have anything to say.
All right, I'm glad to hear that, since you're the director of apologetics. Tim Ryland, who calls himself Second Timothy, just an amazing job.
He does.
And it's beautiful.
It really is. And over the years, you know, it's kind of morphed from time to time. We've moved in different directions. And I think right now,
yeah,
it is the best it's ever been. And a huge part of that goes to Tim.
Yeah, it really is really good. Yeah. And you, there's always something where you go, I got to read that. Not every article, but every issue, I got to read that.
Absolutely.
You can get a $10 break on your one-year subscription, a $20 break off a two-year subscription, and $5 off an all-digital subscription when you go to shop.catholic.com.
I've got an article.
No, I'm sorry, CatholicAnswersMagazine.com. My apologies. Gotcha. CatholicAnswersMagazine.com.
I've got an article coming up on Seventh-day Adventism that I guarantee you, everybody listening right now, you get the magazine, you read that article, you're going to learn something.
Well, this is...
And now I can't tell them, though, because now they have to get the magazine.
Right, you can't say... Now we'll probably get a call on Seventh-day Adventism. But this is interesting. I find this interesting about you is you do all this studying and preparing on a topic like that because you also produced a...
CD set.
A CD set. I wasn't sure if it was a DVD set. But
four talks, and it's in production right now.
Okay, great. And so then you produced an article on the Seventh-day Adventists.
Correct.
And I'm going to just skip ahead. They're wrong, right?
About a lot of stuff. They're right about some stuff, too.
Okay, well, sure. Nobody can be wrong about everything. Head over to CatholicAnswersMagazine.com and get your deal on this. Because you know what? Later, you're going to be like, oh, I should have got Catholic Answers Magazine when it was on sale. Now I got to pay full price. And you will, because it's a fine magazine. Why not just do yourself a favor? Get 10, 20 bucks off. a 1 or 2 year subscription. CatholicAnswersMagazine.com. Time to go to Ryan in Washington State, watching on YouTube. Ryan, we got you there with us. Ryan.
Hello, Ryan. Line two. We got Ryan?
No, we got
I'm sorry, my mute was on.
Uh-huh. Oh.
Are you there?
Yes, that is awesome. For once, it wasn't me, Ryan. I am so happy. I feel like I should send you a free book or something. Thank you so much for being the guy that, well, had it on mute. Go ahead, your question for Tim.
Okay. Well, my question concerns the biblical flood, the historical flood we have. And according to scientists and geologists, there is no historical evidence for the biblical flood on a global scale. Mm-hmm. And they say it's basically just a myth. So how do we back that up or refute that?
Right. Great. Great question, Ryan. And I think while it is true, the scientists that I've talked to and read will say that, we also know that there have been historically large localized floods all around the world. And so, and I know this is kind of a controversial subject among Catholics, but the church kind of opened the door back in 1906. The Pontifical Biblical Commission opened the door to investigate and basically said that if in fact it, you know, is discovered that this may well be the use of a particular literary genre, or perhaps it is an example of a localized flood, as I mentioned before, all of those things were opened up as possibles in studying this. Now, the onus is on those to demonstrate why these would be the case. I will tell you what I believe, Ryan, is that there was indeed. I don't see how you can say there was not a flood. We have cultures all around the world that have in their cosmology and such speak of a flood. So it seems to be something that happened historically. But Ryan, one way to argue it is that the flood was worldwide, but Ryan, it was the world of the ancient people. They did not know about the New World, right? There was no United States of America, right? There was no Canada and all of that. And so it may well be that the flood simply covered the area in which Noah lived. And so it is a worldwide flood because that is their entire world. And this is not contradicting sacred scripture and the images that our Lord uses of Noah and the flood, because absolutely, and I do believe, and I believe as Catholics, we believe in a real historical flood. It's a real event. What is open to debate is whether it was a universal flood. And I tend to agree with you, Ryan, and with the scientists. I don't see the evidence either for a worldwide flood. But just, I would say this as well, just because of the science, that's not a reason to deny it, because there's all sorts of things in the Bible that we've not found historical evidence for. But my goodness, every time you turn a spade in the Middle East, you know, over the last few hundred years, we're discovering more and more that the stories turn up absolutely historical. All right. So theologically speaking, this is where we want to begin. And I think from a Catholic perspective, what you see in the Catechism, for example, and in our theology as it has developed in the last 100 years, is understanding that the first 11 chapters of Genesis are, and this is the other argument that I mentioned at the outset, you have the argument of a localized flood, but you also have the argument, and I don't think it's an either or, I think it's a both and here. You have the argument that the first 11 chapters of Genesis are not intended to be taken as strict literal history. History, absolutely, the church teaches it. It is teaching historical events, but it does so in a particular literary genre where it was not intended. For example, as you know, Ryan, St. Augustine famously said, as did Origen, that the days of creation, according to Augustine, and origin were obviously not intended to be taken as 24-hour periods of time. Why is that? Because you have days before the fourth day, which is when God created the sun and the moon. You can't have a day without a sun. So we're talking about a particular literary genre, where certain things are being taught to us as a historical reality. We have two original parents, Adam and Eve, from whom we all descend. That's to defend original sin, Romans chapter 5, verse 12. God is the creator. Each human soul is created directly and immediately by God. There are certain essentials that are being taught. But when it comes to, you know, the talking snake, and I would argue the flood, these things have to be understood in a particular way. And so that's kind of the gist of it. I wish we had more time, Ryan, but I hope that helps.
Got to take a break. We'll be right back with more Open Forum with Tim Staples.
Hang on. We'll be right back with more Catholic Answers Live.
Jesus asked his disciples, "Who do you say that I am?" Turns out that today, as back then, this question has a lot of different answers. So many groups want to appropriate Jesus, tweaking his identity until he looks and sounds just like one of them. But then you no longer have the Lord, says apologist Trent Horn. You have an imposter. In his new groundbreaking book, Counterfeit Christ, Trent exposes 18 phony versions of Jesus that we encounter today, helping you to recognize the fakes when you see them, explain why they're phony, and make a case for the full truth and beauty of who Jesus is, the Christ, the Son of the living God. Order your copy of Counterfeit Christ today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. It's free, and you'll have instant access to our daily broadcast, the schedule of upcoming shows, and you'll even be able to search the archive and listen to thousands of past shows. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
Have you subscribed to the Catholic Answers Radio Club newsletter? This is Catholic Answers Live host Cy Kellett, and I want to tell you about our new weekly newsletter full of behind-the-scenes information and facts you need to know about the show. It's easy to sign up. Just visit CatholicAnswersLive.com and look for the newsletter sign-up box on the front of the page. It's a great way to keep up to date with what's happening with the show and see what's coming in the days ahead, delivered weekly into your inbox. Sign up today for the Catholic Answers Radio Club newsletter and see what you've been missing. Go to CatholicAnswersLive.com.
Tomorrow on More to Life, peace at last.
Are you looking for a break from stress? We're going to help you increase your peace.
Now, back to Catholic Answers Live.
Open Forum, lots of calls, so I'll just get right to them. Tim Staples, our guest, and Nick is listening on the Catholic Answers app. Nick, are you there with us?
Yes, I am.
Oh, that's so good. All right,
Nick. Thank you for taking my call.
Happy to. Your question.
Awesome. Thank you. My question is, and I have like a little thing I need to cite here just as a caveat to this, but I'm always just wondering, from a Catholic perspective, what is appropriate in a dating relationship as far as affection goes? And I guess I would just, to like put like some context as my main concern here, is something from EWTN, which it's like one of their articles on this, and it's quoting something with pure intent. And I'm just going to read this, and then just I want you to comment on it.
Okay.
It says, the boy who modestly kisses a girl and becomes aroused, but does not intend the arousal, has not even sinned venially, nor does he sin if he remains aroused, but does not will or desire the arousal. However, as soon as he begins to enjoy the arousal or desire it, then it is time to stop whatever action is causing the arousal, even if it is a morally good or neutral action. To continue would be to commit sin. And I ran into this issue because I, the human being, and feel as though I am particularly sensitive to these sort of things, even if they are very, you know, respectful and modest. And I just wondered if you could comment on that.
I think that article is spot on. That is, and that's very well said. I would encourage you to take a look at an article I have on my website at timstaples.com. If you just type in the truth about dating there, I have an article. And there's two principles. I absolutely agree with that article. You cannot just lay down a rule that says, now, in my article, I do lay down this rule, and it's rooted in 1 Timothy chapter 5, verses 1 and 2. St. Paul says, "Do not rebuke an older man, but exhort him as you would a father. Treat younger men like brothers, older women like mothers, younger women like sisters in all purity." That is a very important principle for dating. You don't do anything with your date that you wouldn't do with your sister. There's nothing wrong. Now, people say, what? What? I would. You should not do anything on a date that you would not or at least could not do with your sister. For example, it's fine to hold your sister's hand. It's fine to give your sister a peck on the cheek or even on the lips. In fact, in some cultures, men kiss each other on the lips. I'm glad I'm not in that culture. I just want to say.
I'm glad you're not too, because I'm much more comfortable over here.
But there's a very important principle here, isn't it? This is a very important principle. If you treat her like a sister, why? Because that's what she is. She's not your wife. You're dating her. And even if you're engaged, you haven't signed on the dotted line yet. Now, I know I have friends who do not kiss at all until their wedding day. God bless them. You know, that is a wonderful thing. But I think the principle, if you lay out that first principle there, I mean, things like French kissing, come on, that's crazy. Anybody who argues that is okay dating is insane. I mean, give me a break. You're a human being. That is something that prepares you for the marital act. Let's just put it that way, right? So a lot of this is common sense. But at the same time, I think the article you read makes an excellent point. Because for some people, even holding hands might be too much.
Uh-huh.
Because their passions are really out of control. And, you know, their girlfriend or fiance doesn't even know it. That's a time to say, you know what, let's go with a group. Let's go to a movie with a group of people and so forth. So I think we need to respect each other. When we're dating, respect the one that you're dating. Be sensitive to them because your girlfriend or your boyfriend may not be in the same place you are. And so if they're having difficulty, we need to help them in that as well. But again, I think that article is excellent. And check out, again, The Truth About Dating at timstaples.com. And I'll give you one last little not really an aside, because I think it pertains to the topic directly. I don't like dating. I just think dating was created in the pit of hell. That's just me, Si. And why do I say that? Because I really believe in courting, in the idea of going out with a group. If you can go out, you know, like Far and Away, you know, the movie John Wayne.
I don't know.
Oh, you don't know that one? No. Oh my gosh, it's a great movie, John. What, you got to see that? Put on.
All
the,
right, I'll on put the it on list the list.
With John Wayne, when he goes out with his future wife, the whole family and the cows and everything are following.
They're all following along.
All following by. You got that in The Godfather too. Remember when?
Yes, right. Yeah,
when Michael Corleone was.
But
in
everyone
Italy.
Goes for a walk.
That's
you
right.
You just all go for a walk.
You just all go for a walk, and you stay together. And that's courting, and mm-hmm. It's really respectful. It's understanding, number one, we're a fallen people. And my goodness, dating is it's so dangerous because you're putting two people who may well be falling in love with each other. Okay, go off on your own, in a car, yeah. By yourself, in the dark, whatever. I mean, you're setting people up for a fall. And I think culturally, as Catholics, we should understand that we should protect one another and respect one another enough to protect one another. Anyway, check it out. I got it all there. TimStaples.com, The Truth About Dating.
Thanks, Nick. Thank you very much for that call. We go now to Anonymous in Florida, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Anonymous, are you there with us?
Hey, guys. Thank you for taking my call.
Happy to.
I just had a question regarding in New Jersey. It was brought to my attention via Facebook that a Catholic church is offering offering mass in support of the LGBT community. And so my question for Tim is that priest committing heresy in that case?
Right. No, certainly that would not be a case of heresy just for offering a mass under that title, because he's not openly denying an essential teaching of the church now, or an infallible teaching of the church. If he were to say that homosexual acts are fine and good, and homosexual marriage is good, and hey, come together, we're going to have homosexual marriages, that would be heretical. All right, there you're denying an infallible teaching of the church. Here, what we have, Anonymous, is an extremely imprudent situation, in my humble opinion, for this reason. If you're going to have a mass for a particular community, in my opinion, Cy, and you pipe in here, I think to identify a community, I have a real problem with folks identifying themselves by a particular attraction to a particular sin.
Mm-hmm.
I have a real problem with that, and I know it's becoming more and more popular in Christian culture and Catholic culture to do it. So, I mean, I question that at the core. I mean, I understand that I have a problem with the catechism refers to homosexual persons, and I get that. But the catechism had no intention of with that. I mean, basically what the catechism is saying is we have persons, and that's the emphasis in the catechism. These are persons that must not be discriminated against unjustly and so forth. And they have same-sex attraction. I get that. But what I don't like is that has led to this identifying by an impulse. And Anonymous, that's, I think, the problem that we're kind of catering to, unfortunately, in some areas in the Catholic Church. And I think often unwittingly, they're trying to reach out to this community of people who suffer from same-sex attraction. That's a good thing. And I would imagine, now I don't know this particular case here, that's probably what they're doing. They're reaching out to bring these people in and help them to understand that, look, you know, having an impulse is not a sin. It's not a sin to have same-sex attraction. Some people simply have it through no fault of their own. Some of these people have been abused from the time they were children. There's all sorts of possibilities here. And I get this. I think it's extremely important. We have groups like Courage, our own president, Father, or our president's brother, Father Paul Cech, used to direct that wonderful group of Courage, and that dealt with people who suffer from same-sex attraction. So Anonymous, there's nothing wrong with that if this is what they're trying to do there. It's just when you start identifying, that's where the problem comes in. And I think anthropologically and I think theologically, there's a real issue here, a level of imprudence that's disturbing. And what you find in a lot of these instances, I can't speak to the one in New Jersey, is you have problems in these parishes with indifferentism.
Yeah,
because it becomes, see, this is the thing, Cy and Anonymous, it starts with, well, we're just reaching out to this community. Oh, God bless you. And it ends with, oh, it's fine.
Mm-hmm.
It's fine. You're created that way. And all sorts of things like that, to where the act itself becomes justified. And that's the real danger. So Anonymous, no, it's not heretical to have a mass offered for the LGBTQ community, although that needs to be explained, I think, very clearly. You're talking about ministering to a people that have a serious disorder of character, and they need to be ministered to. Why? Because we all are disordered, my friends. All of us, by virtue of the fall, are disordered. We all have our tendencies. A again, anonymous in sight. It's just this, why is it that this one sin, and now more sins, now we're also including transgenderism and all sorts of things. And there you get into a whole nother issue of mutilation, you know, mutilation.
Yes.
You know, of these poor people.
Right.
In the name of, we're accepting you just as you are. And so, you know, we have to be clear, anonymous, and I pray this parish is, that what we're talking about are people who suffer from this disorder, who are suffering from same-sex attraction, but acting on that disorder, just as Cy and I and everybody in here have disordered passions, we have to order those disordered passions toward right, in accordance with right reason and the moral teachings of the church. And I'm afraid, Anonymous, that's what often does not happen in these parishes. And I guess I can leave it at that.
Thanks very much, Anonymous, for that. How did you know that I have disordered passions? I've been trying to hide that. I don't share that with the people. All right, we'll take a break. We'll be right back with more Open Forum with Tim Staples right after this.
There's only one. Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
A lot of people think that street evangelization involves yelling out of a bullhorn telling people that they're going to hell. Not so with St. Paul's Street Evangelization. Our methods are non-confrontational and effective. We simply offer information on the Catholic faith along with rosaries, miraculous medals, and prayer. Pope Francis wrote about how beautiful it is to see street preachers joyfully bringing Jesus to every corner of the earth. Street evangelization is fun and fruitful. Join us today at streetevangelization.com.
The wisdom of Mother Angelica.
Now, when Jesus was on earth, he taught us a great lesson. He taught us that he came for the sinner, not the virtuous. He came for you because you are imperfect, because sin comes easy to you, and sometimes you don't have the willpower to say no.
EWTN, live truth, live Catholic.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Tim Staples is our guest for both hours, lines are pretty, no lines are full right now, but so you want to, when a line opens up, go ahead and dial 888-31-TRUTH so that you can get in with your question on anything about the Catholic faith, whether you're Catholic or not, you're welcome to. And no matter who you are, you should also come to our conference. And I'm talking about this now because I have a note in my hand that says, the block of rooms that we have at the hotel is already 2/3 sold, and we are months away from the conference. So it says here 3.5 months to go. So if you're coming from out of town to the Catholic Answers Conference, you're going to want to make your reservation now. You just go to CatholicAnswersConference.com. There's early bird pricing until July 2nd, which is almost upon us. Early bird pricing until July 2nd. Go to CatholicAnswersConference.com. The early church was the Catholic Church is the name of it. Tim Staples will be there. You will, right?
Yes, I will. God willing, if the creek don't rise.
All right, because we've had problems with the creek.
Yes.
So, yeah. you got to put that in there, disclaimer. Right. you're gonna talk about what at the conference?
I am going to talk about Mary, the Mother of God in the early church, and why it matters. What's all the fuss about with this Mary, Mother of God?
Okay.
And I'll kind of branch off a little bit into Mariology in general, and people will be very surprised at how developed the Mariology of the church was from day one. I'm going to have some fun with this one.
I think a lot of people wouldn't believe it. I'm sure many of the people who come, we're gathering with Catholics, but I think a lot of people wouldn't believe it. They say, no, Tim, look, this all came, this is much like Constantine, whatever they
That's
say.
Right. Come to this conference. I guarantee you're going to learn something.
All right. And have you ever visited Mary's tomb?
I have not.
Has anyone ever visited Mary's tomb?
Well, she has two.
Oh, okay.
She has one in Ephesus and one in Jerusalem, and of course, both of them are empty. And you know, that makes sense, right? Yeah. I talk about this in my book.
Oh, yeah, because right.
Because she lived with John in Ephesus. There would have been a tomb for her there. And she lived in Jerusalem, so there would have been a tomb for her there as well. And according to the stronger of the traditions, you know, there's a tradition that she never died.
Yeah.
Timothy of Jerusalem in the 4th century taught that. St. Epiphanius in the 4th century taught that.
But the more common one is that
she died. And actually, the ordinary teaching of the church is that she died. That's actually the it's not infallible, but it's the ordinary teaching of the church, in fact, that she died. We had the Feast of the Dormition, in fact, before the Assumption. It was called the Dormition. And the tradition, as you find it in St. Gregory of Tours, for example, he writes about how the apostles came and Mary was laid in state there, and the apostles, all but one, came from all over the world and saw her as she had died. And after 3 days, like her son, she was assumed, and in their presence, they actually saw her. So, yes, she does have a tomb. In fact, she has two tombs.
Because she does, yeah.
But they're both empty.
All right, so the conference is called The Early Church Was the Catholic Church, talks on all kinds of things. Did the earliest Christians, I mean the earliest Christians, right at the earliest times, did they celebrate the sacraments? Did they have a hierarchy that looked anything like the hierarchy of the Catholic Church today?
Yes.
Did they love and revere Mary right from the beginning? Well,
yeah,
you're going to find out all about that.
And believe me, folks, this conference is going to be the best one yet. Yeah. When you look at the speakers we have, it's incredible. I've said this before, I'd come just to see Monsignor Eugene Morris.
Yes.
I mean, the man is brilliant. But we've got what do we have, five guest speakers?
Five guest speakers. Yeah, Monsignor Morris, Father David McConey, Rod Bennett's going to come. Bishop Frank Caggiano from Bridgeport, Connecticut is coming.
Incredible.
And then Father Paul Check, who you mentioned earlier.
And you're going to have Chris Check, Tim Staples, Carlo Broussard, and Jimmy Akin.
And also we'll do the radio program.
Amen.
So you get to ask your question.
It's going to be too much fun, folks. And the Q&A panel is always the funnest.
Yeah, it is. CatholicAnswersConference.com. CatholicAnswersConference.com. We go now to Chase in Harrisonburg, Virginia, watching on Facebook Live. Chase, thanks for joining us on Facebook Live. Your question for Tim.
Hi, Cy and Tim. Thank you guys for taking my call. God bless y'all for doing what you do. Love listening to you guys.
All right, brother.
Thank you.
Yeah. My question is, how do you respond to a moral relativist and determinist who believes we should impose our morality on others for the benefit of society?
Yeah, well, it sounds
and
like...
would you have a good...
Mm-hmm? Yeah, it sounds like you've got a very confused friend here. A moral relativist... So is he saying we have to impose moral relativism on everyone? In other words, to say there's no... nothing is objectively moral or immoral?
Something like that. So he would say that we can't be certain of a moral truth, even though we can't be certain of a moral truth, but we should impose our morality on others because then there wouldn't really be much of a point.
Well, Chase, I think you can see from his own argumentation, he's not making any sense. So we're going to impose this on everyone, even though we have no idea, we don't know whether it's true or not. That is not, just from a pragmatic point of view, is insane. We're going to force you, but we don't really know whether it's true or not. You know, I think just from a pragmatic standpoint, this seems to be crazy. Now, as far as determinism goes, he doesn't believe in free will, but he believes, I'm assuming, that you should coerce people to obey you and be a moral relativist that doesn't believe in any morality. I mean, this thing, it just causes your head to spin. I think the bottom line, what you have to do is show him the absurdity of his arguments. By saying, okay, first of all, if you're saying moral relativism must be forced upon people, what are you saying about moral relativism? And why should anybody listen to you? If you don't even know whether it's true or not, What are you going to do? Are you going to then take up arms? I mean, I would just press him to the core on this thing. Okay, how do you force this morality? You're saying by law. Do you get a bigger police force? Chase, let's see, it's Chase, right? Chase, I think you should use the reductio ad absurdum in a case like this where you have a person who's so confused in his own premises, you know, just press him on it. The Socratic method is the best way to do it here. Just continue to ask questions. Okay, so how do you enforce it? And have you gotten into that with him, Chase? Like, okay, how do you enforce this relativist morality on people? What does that look like governmentally? I would love to hear from him.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think because what you can do is reduce him to absurdity. Okay, so you're going to force, you know, once he does lay out kind of a, and by the way, Chase, this is an important point to make in apologetics in general. Trent Horn is the master at this, you know, just asking questions. You know, the Socratic method or the Columbo method of apologetics, right? Let me ask you one more question. It's a fantastic way. Jesus used it. Obviously, Socrates used it very well. When you ask questions, and this happened to me, Chase, in my Odyssey to the Catholic Faith, some of the best things that my buddy Matt Dula did for me was to ask me questions. Okay, so you believe in sola scriptura, okay? So how do you know that 3 John should be in the Bible, right? Never mentions the name Jesus Christ. We don't know to this day who wrote it. There's debate as to who wrote it. So how do you know? That's a great way to get people to think. So in a case like this, where you have a guy who's a determinist, so there's no free will, but we're going to impose our morality on you. So what does that mean? I'm going to determine it for you with the force of arms or
right.
knives or guns, but I'm a moral relativist, so I don't even know if what I'm doing is right or
I'm
wrong.
I'm pretty sure it's right, enough to enforce it on you.
That's right. I mean, you just keep pressing him on it,
yeah.
And a lot of times that is what can open yeah. up the conversation to the point where you can see, introduce, Chase, the idea of natural law. You know, actually, we can have moral certainty about human actions, just as we can have certainty, for example, and kind of launch into that, Chase. We can have certainty, and I think your friend would agree, if you go up to an oak tree and you see its roots planted in the ground, you can say, look, we can say that this oak tree has a particular nature, and if I go over there and pour battery acid on its roots, guess what's going to happen? It's not good for the oak tree. Why? Because that's contrary to its nature. By nature, it needs water and nutrients to grow and to flourish. So if I pour battery acid on it, I'm going to damage its nature. We see that in everything that we do, in science, in medicine. The reason why Cy Kellett and I could both have appendicitis and the doctor will treat us the same way is because the doctor knows we have the same nature, right? And the same nature responds the same way to the particular treatments. So it is with the conjugal act, for example. And it's a good way to enter into it, Chase, to help someone to see. We can look at the sexual act just like we look at an oak tree or we look at human nature, size, yeah. intestines and Tim Staples' intestines to know what to do if he has bad intestines and I have bad intestines. Well, the sexual act is designed by God. It has a design built right in there to be for the union of one man, one woman. In fact, the man and woman's bodies are designed that way. They're ordered to each other. The union of one man and one woman and procreation. So if you act contrary to that, you're acting contrary to nature. And when you introduce the idea of God here, God created this nature. And the only way we as rational beings can flourish and attain our ultimate end, which is union with God, is by acting in accordance with that nature. You're off to the races in starting a real discussion about how you can have real moral certainty in matters of the moral law.
Chase, I hope that was helpful to you. I have a suspicion it was. Thanks very much for that call. There's lots of folks on the line, but there's a line open. So if you want to dial now, 888-318-7884. We might be able to get to you because we got another hour coming up. Tim Staples is going to stay for another hour. If you're on the line, please stay on the line. We'll get to your question. If you haven't called yet and you'd like to try to get that one line open, 888-318-7884 is the number. Heaven, I don't know if we've heard too many non-Catholics today. So if you're a non-Catholic and you'd like to know something about the Catholic faith, we'll bump you up to the top when you call 888-318-7884.